I cannot imagine. I took sitters through other sources, too. The Society for Psychical Research, there. Officials and members of which always showed me the greatest sympathy and consideration, were all delightful sitters with whom it was a pleasure and satisfaction to work. How greatly the sitter can help one's mediumship to develop. The wise, cautious, even skeptical sitter, if he has an open mind, gets the best results, and is a great factor in definitely building up, little by little, the psychical and mental forces of the medium, and even of the control. The credulous, I'm willing to believe anything, my dear. I don't want tests, kind of sitter does not improve the quality of one's mediumship, nor get the best results. Skepticism of a reasonable kind is often a good condition in the early stages of investigation. Such a one I have in mind, and he is Mr. Robert Blatchford, who was certainly very skeptical, as everybody knows, at first, but when he obtained what he considered to be evidence, he acknowledged it, and since then he must have helped many thousands by his courageous statements of his beliefs and opinions. 44. In spite of all the encouragement and friendly help that I received, I found that there constant strain of sitting for all kinds and types of people was very great. You see, they were nearly all bereaved, terribly bereaved, plunged into the depths of grief and loneliness so suddenly. Had I dared to let myself dwell upon it, I should have been overwhelmed by the sadness of it all. Only by saying to myself, you know it's terrible, awful, but don't be a sentimental, selfish fool. Don't waste time and power in contemplating the obvious, but pull yourself together, so as to give the right peaceful conditions, so that those who have left this dreadful chaotic state on earth may draw near to you, and communicate through you. I knew instinctively that I must mentally provide a calm, harmonious condition, so as to make things as easy as possible for the spirit communicators. This was impressed on me again and again by Feder, who herself is such a joyous, optimistic little person, that I feel sure she must have influenced me enormously during those trying years. Also there. Knowledge that, because of the sittings, people were being lifted out of despair and hopelessness, into leading normal and useful lives again, helped me to struggle against the difficulties and trials of that period. You see, I had become so sure of my facts. I no longer, as in my early youth, hoped and despaired alternately. Little by little, the guides and communicators on the other side made me know. Sometimes sitters would tell me about the proof that had been given them through Feder, which was very helpful to me. I think I will relate a little of this evidence as it will help you to know the kind of material, simple yet definite, that helped the bereaved sitter, and also impressed me. Page 45. Chapter 14, Some Evidence of Survival. In 1916 the lady, Mrs. Kelway Bamber, came to see me, whose son, Claude, an airman, had been killed in France. She obtained a great deal of personal evidence from him, which convinced her that it was undoubtedly her son who was communicating. One day, when she came to have a sitting with me, he said to her, "Mummy, I know that you often wish I could give you a test that would be absolutely watertight, something that no one on earth knows anything about." His mother said, "Yes, I wish you could do that, it would help so many people to believe in the afterlife if I could tell them something that excluded the theory of telepathy." "Well, Mummy," he replied, "do you remember a boy who was a particular friend of mine at school? We always called him Little Willy." Here he gave her several particulars, which clearly established the other boy's identity. The mother said at once, "Of course, I remember him, but we haven't heard of him for some time." Her son proceeded, Willy has just passed over. He has been killed in France, shot down in an aeroplane. His body is in a spot where it is not likely to be found for some time. I have been helping his soul to get away from the body and the conditions of war. Because it will be a great shock to him when he awakes and finds out what has happened. No one knows that he is killed, not a living soul on Earth at the moment, because they are not expecting him back at the base yet. He has only just been killed, and I am so glad to have this sitting with you, so that I can tell you about it before anyone else knows. Mrs. Kelway Bamba went immediately to the War Office and made inquiries, but was told that, as far as they knew, the officer in question was safe and sound. A few days later he was reported missing, but it was not till a year later that it was proved he had been killed. It was then found that he had been shot down that very day, just before the sitting. This, I consider, was a test that cannot be explained away by telepathy. About this time a young widow came to me, soon after her husband had been killed. Also in the war. After a few successful sittings, with Fader controlling me, she thought she would like to try a table sitting. Her husband proved himself to be quite an expert. Indeed, he mastered the technique of the sittings from his side remarkably quickly. His control over the table was so perfect that I only needed to keep one hand, my left, very lightly on it, and was able to use my right hand to write down the letters as he spelt them out to us. It was necessary that I should do so, as he moved the table so quickly that we should otherwise have forgotten the order of the letters. While he was giving a message about some ordinary but quite interesting matter, he broke off, changing the subject by saying, "Nora, have you forgotten what today is?" "No," his wife replied, "but I thought you had. Can't you tell me what today means to you, because it is a very special day?" Without the least hesitation the following letters were rapped out quickly on the table. "At Trinity Church at Madum." We looked at the letters, but could make nothing of such a jumble as it seemed. In a disappointed tone, the wife said, "Well, darling, I did think you would remember what today is." "I do," he insisted, "I've told you. Read over carefully what I have spelt out." On reading over again the letters he had given, we found they spelt, "At Trinity Church I met my doom." The wife was delighted, as that day was the anniversary of their wedding day. It was just the kind of thing he would have said, she explained. He wanted to give the test in his own words, in his own way, not hers. Page 47. Chapter 15, Some More Evidence, and a Rebuff. The idea that all evidence can be explained by the theory that the medium simply reads the mind of the sitter and finds certain information there, and makes use of it by mentally and verbally converting it into a supposed communication from a discarnate spirit, is now being worn so threadbare that serious and experienced students of their subject are finding out that that kind of telepathy enters very little, if at all, into a séance with a fully developed medium. If you read such books as the Reverend C. Drayton Thomas' Life Beyond Death, with evidence, and some new evidence for human survival, you will find an immense number of cases recited in which the evidence is of such a nature that it cannot be explained away by the thought-reading hypothesis. It would be a waste of time for me to repeat any of these cases here, as you can all read them for yourselves in full, along with so much other interesting and instructive material. Fader often explains to us that in the spirit world there are what one can only describe as inquiry bureaus, where those who are anxious to send messages to their friends on Earth make contact with some of the experienced communicators, such as Mr. Drayton Thomas's father, and ask them to help, either by taking them to a sitting or carrying a message for them. Of course, I hear very little about the evidence that most of my sitters obtain. A great deal of it would be of too intimate and private a nature for the sitter to retail to me, or to publish it in a book or paper, and often it is undesirable that I should hear anything about it, as the communicator may wish to continue with his evidence, and it is always best that my mind should be as clear as possible about any subject on which a sitter requires further evidence. Personally, I think that the idea of a medium coloring the messages is very much exaggerated, but we have to consider that we are sometimes trying to provide evidence that will convince the skeptic. We are not trying to convert the converted. From time to time I have had remarkable personal evidence given me. I should like to tell you about one very striking example, but as it concerns some relatives who do not like the subject of psychical research, and who strongly disapprove of my work in it, I must disguise the names, as I do not wish consciously to annoy or hurt them. One evening in the autumn of 1914, I visited a friend's flat in Bayswater with the object of meeting two or three other friends and having a table sitting. We had all known each other very well, with the exception of one lady, whom I will call Mrs. C. Through their table several communicators spelt out short messages, none of a very interesting kind. And a short interval came during which the table seemed to become quite dead and still. We waited, wondering if the séance were finished, when suddenly the table began to move again, first in a halting, rather uncertain manner, and then gradually becoming firmer and stronger. A name, Christian and surname, was spelt out. None of their other sitters recognized it. I did, but did not acknowledge it, as I did not for one moment think it was meant for me, as the only person I knew of that name was still, so far as I knew, on earth, and I felt sure I should have heard if he had passed over. So I said nothing. Again the name was spelt out, this time very strongly indeed. The sitter, whom I have called Mrs. C., then said to me, "Mrs. Leonard, I am occasionally clairvoyant, or I sense things, and I am strongly impressed that this communicator knows you, and wishes to speak to you." "Well," I said, "I do know someone of that name. It is the name of an uncle, but he is, I am quite sure, alive and well, or I should have heard. I am certain it cannot be he." As I finished saying this, the table lifted high, and literally banged out, "Yes, I am he. I am your uncle," and I passed out suddenly, again repeating both Christian and surname. I still could not believe it, and asked him the name of his house, which was in a place 200 or 300 miles away and quite unknown to any of the other sitters. This was given correctly. Mrs. C. spoke again, "I can see this communicator so distinctly. He is standing just behind you, Mrs. Leonard. I will describe him to you." She did so minutely, and it was an excellent description, which would have fitted very few people except my uncle, who had a very unusual personality. I felt, then, that it must be he, and told him I was glad he had come to me, as my mother and I had been very fond of him. He was an exceptionally good and kind man, if ever there was one. He then proceeded to give me some information about his youngest son, information that again it seemed impossible to credit. He said that this son had been detained as a prisoner in Germany. This did not fit in at all with what I had known of the family's recent plans and movements. I was more puzzled than ever. He then asked me to write and tell his wife, my aunt, that he had communicated, and said she would verify all his statements. I promised to do so. I, and the other sitters, were extremely interested in the whole communication. We immediately wrote out all he had said, while it was fresh in our minds, and we all signed and dated it. On reaching home, I read out the statement to my husband, who said that he could not. Imagine my uncle had passed over, or I should have heard about it from one of my relatives, most certainly from my aunt. I then thought of my promise to write and tell my aunt that uncle had spoken to me. How could I word the letter, I wondered. As my husband said, I could not write and say, "Please, aunt, is uncle dead?" No matter how tactfully I might put the matter, it would really amount to that, so I simply wrote and said that I hadn't heard from her for a few weeks and that I particularly wanted to know if things were all right at home. My aunt wrote in reply saying she was sorry she had not written, but my uncle had passed over very suddenly 3 weeks before, and there had been a great deal of business suddenly forced on her. She also said my uncle had been worried by the fact that his youngest son happened to be passing through Germany on the outbreak of war, and had been detained there. This confirmation of all my uncle had told us through the table was most striking, and I immediately sent to my aunt their signed statement of what had happened at the sitting. How glad she will be to know that he has already taken steps to communicate in order to show his love and interest in us all, I thought, but I was mistaken. My aunt wrote back that she hoped I would never refer to the matter again, and that I would not disturb my uncle, but allow him to rest in peace. I could see it would be helpless to explain to her that I had not disturbed him. He had disturbed me, in a most determined manner, and I was very glad that he had done so. At the first opportunity I told him quietly what Auntie had said. He probably knew it, and told him I could not send on any further messages from him. He said he understood, and that he was quite content. It was only what he had half expected, but that he would keep in touch with me from time to time. I did not hear much about him, but I hope he still feels interested in me and thinks of me, even if his life and work, I am sure he is busy and active in his present life, do not bring him into close contact with earth life. Chapter 16, in which I find my father. Lose him and find him again. A very strong chain of evidential matter was woven round my father, my reunion with him, and his subsequent passing over. In an early chapter one told you that financial losses had unsettled my father's mind to such an extent that he seemed to lose all sense of his material responsibilities as a husband and father. Here, I must remark, that I am quite sure I was his favorite child. I was very fond of him indeed, and being the eldest, I was old enough to understand him better than my brothers or sister could be expected to do. After we left him, he made several attempts to persuade me to go and live with him. He had a great mastery of many different languages, understanding and speaking fluently French, Italian, German and other less known tongues, and had from time to time done correspondence and other work during different continental and Near East wars. He could act as interpreter under difficult and complicated conditions, and, of course, also teach languages, but had not the patience to do it. If I had left my mother and gone to him, I should undoubtedly have had an easier and more interesting, though bohemian, life, traveling abroad with him. He was a fascinating companion at times, though at others he was dreadfully sarcastic and cynical in an amusing, but extremely cruel way. One would never be dull with him. He was certainly what is known as a dual personality, because behind all his charm, cleverness and love of the unusual, was a curious orthodox and conventional streak, which was undoubtedly responsible for his refusal to allow me to ask any questions about, or see anything of, what he called the supernatural. I longed to join him. It was a great temptation, but we children all felt that our right place was with our mother, so I stayed. Perhaps I was impressed to do so. On the other hand, had I been alone with my father, I might have brought him round to my way of thinking regarding spiritualism. Subsequent events made me think this would have been possible, though I should not have thought so at the time. Now, after I reached the age of 17 or 18, till I was 32, I had neither seen nor heard from my father, and did not know if he was on this plane or not. When the war broke out in August 1914, it brought him very much to my mind again, as he had taken part in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, on the French side. I had a great friend, Beatrice Chester, who knew all about him, and one evening when I was at her house in Regent's Park, she suggested that we might have a little table sitting, and see if any of my father's relatives who had passed over would come and give me information about him. I gladly agreed, and we sat in the usual way. To my surprise, someone came through, who said his name was William Edward and that he was my father's brother. I would not believe this, because I had understood that my father had no other brother than one named Harry. "Hello," I said, "do you mean that you are Harry?" He said, "No, I am your father's eldest brother." I said, "You are wrong, then, because my father had no eldest brother, he was the eldest." He said, "I am his brother, but I died before your father was born." I said, "How can you be William, because there are no two sons in the same family called by the same Christian name, and my father was William." He said, "Notwithstanding that, he was right." I replied, "Very well, have you seen your alleged brother at all lately?"
"Yes."
"Where? Is he on the continent?"
"No, he is in England."
"Can you tell me anything about where he may be?"
"Yes, in Leeds."
I said, "No, that cannot be." I thought, "Why should he be in Leeds? That is one of their very towns he would not be in." However, I made inquiries, and through my brother I found out that my father had been seen in Leeds. My brother, at the same time as he wrote about this, sent me on an old bag containing some papers, as he was moving from the place where he was living to another. In this bag I found a torn envelope with the Leeds postmark, which gave the last three letters of the name of a road, Iron. I thought from this it was evident he had been in Leeds, so I said I would try and find out from the spirit, who called himself my father's brother, whether he could tell me anything more about it. Accordingly, at the earliest opportunity I asked him whether he could possibly find out any address my father ever had in Leeds, or was likely to be found at. After a lot of trouble and mistaken spellings, he spelt out the words, "Caledonian Road, Leeds." I could not get the number of the road, but I thought I would write to my father at that address and see what came of it. To my great astonishment, a fortnight afterwards, I got an answer from my father, but from quite a different address. He said he had moved from the Caledonian Road, which was a long thoroughfare, and without any number it was most unlikely that any letter would have found him, but some people in the road, of whom the postman made inquiries, took the trouble to tell him where my father had probably gone, and the postal authorities sent on my letter to that address. In his reply my father said he was very pleased and astonished to hear from me. He said he would like to know what I was doing, and asked if it would be possible to see me. I answered I should be delighted to meet him. Would he come to see me? I tried to explain to him what I was doing, for by this time I was working professionally as a medium. It was in the winter of 1914. I saw that in his next letter he rather ignored what I, 52, had said about my work, though he was as tactful as he could be. He told me he could not come to see me as he was not very well, and could not get about easily.
Incidentally, he told me he had married again. My mother had passed on some years before. He did not propose that I should go to him, but I found that in the Christmas week my husband had a little business in Wakefield, which is not far from Leeds. I wired to my father asking if he could come to a certain address at Wakefield, which is only a tram ride from Leeds. He replied, yes. My husband and I went to Wakefield, and my father came to see us. We met at the tram terminus. He did not know me, but I recognized him immediately. We took him to the place we were staying at and had lunch. Then I asked my husband to leave us together for a confidential talk, and I broached the subject of my work to my father. He said to me, well, I have always doubted mediums and thought they were frauds. That there might be a certain element of thought reading and telepathy about it, and a suggestion of hypnotism, but I believe you are fairly level-headed, and fairly conscientious, and I don't believe you would set out seriously in such a thing as this without believing it to be true. I replied, I thought you would know that, and that I would not take it up in this way unless I had proved it to be true. Do you think anybody can return? He asked. I said, yes, anybody who wishes to do so can, provided there is someone on the earth plane who also wishes to communicate. To which he answered, well, when I pass over, as you call it, I will come back to you. He asked me to explain one or two things about communicating, and I told him how he could give a message through a table, or show himself to a medium so that she could describe him, or tried to think of something to convince me that it was he. He said, all right, I will do that when I pass on, but I feel pretty well at present. I told him as much as I could about the subject, and he became more and more interested, and asked endless questions. Then he said suddenly, do you know I have heard a voice, an objective voice, several times during the last few weeks? Oh, I exclaimed, how interesting. What does the voice say? Die on the 15th of January, he replied. The voice never says anything else, but always that, die on the 15th of January. I don't know whose death is meant. Perhaps it's the damned old Kaiser, he added, with a laugh. I never saw my father again in the flesh. He died on the morning of the 15th of January. Only 2 weeks after he had told me about the message. I do not understand why the voice told him about the date, or how it knew. I only record it as an interesting incident. About 3 days after my father passed over, I was resting on my bed in the afternoon, reading, when my attention was drawn by a movement of some kind near the side of their bed. I looked up and was astonished to see my father standing in front of me. I saw him just as distinctly as one can see any ordinary earthly person. He stood between my bed and the fireplace, facing the bright winter sunshine that streamed in upon him from their window. I noticed that his body was solid, and it completely blocked out part of their mantelpiece and fireplace. I looked at him, he looked at me, with a rather, I'm a clever boy, told you I'd do it sort of expression. He appeared to be several years younger than on my last meeting with him, bright, alert and upright, his face wreathed in smiles. I could see he was delighted to be able to show himself to me. I could have touched him by stretching out my hand. For a moment I forgot he was dead and thought he was there, in his physical body. In the next, I remembered and, overjoyed and overawed, I managed to whisper, oh, Dad. He smiled even more, nodded his head and vanished. I was glad to think that he had found it possible to make me see him, but, oh, the many things I thought of afterwards that I wished I had said to him while he stood there, just in front of me. It was only a